Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about President Trump's immigration executive order signed late last Friday. My guests are D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, Howard University political science professor Dr. Lorenzo Morris, D.C. ACLU legal director Arthur Spitzer. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me talk to, I believe this is Taki calling from Colombia. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you so much. What's on your mind?
Just the ban that, you know, President Trump decided to, you know, sign that executive order. I mean, it's asinine. And when you look at it, it's not a ban on refugees or immigrants. It's a ban on Muslims. So he's banned the Muslims from these seven countries. And he likes to cite that, you know, this is, you know, trying to prevent 9/11 attacks from rehappening. But none of these countries, the people that were involved in the 9/11 attacks was involved in these countries. They were from Saudi Arabia, UAE and Egypt. But all of those countries are open. And it just seems that the countries that he does business with, or there's some type of business that he does, they're not banned. And the countries that he did ban, they also have, they're all in agreement that they disapprove of Russia and what Russia's doing in Syria and things like that. And we all know that President Trump cozies up to President Putin from Russia. So it just seems that, you know, him doing this towards Muslims, like his wife is an immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
He is a son of a German immigrant. But now he's in a position, he's saying, you know, we're going to prevent attacks from happening. You can't single out an entire religion, because then if you say that, then it's like, the KKK, does that mean that the KKK represents all Christians? Because they did a bunch of things in the name of Christianity and God and stuff like that.
Okay.
So it's just thinking about what President Trump is doing. He's doing this. I think it's to me, it's like he's setting himself up to line his pockets so when he's out.
Hmm. Okay. And, well, Taki, thank you so much. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Joe, calling from Bowie. Thanks for calling, Joe. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm calling because this executive order is especially troubling, but also the response to the federal judges not agreeing with the executive order is also troubling. The Trump administration is ignoring judges who have ruled this executive order unlawful or have said that components should no longer be practiced or exist. So when are we going to discuss the power struggle here, the lack of checks and balances between the president and the judicial branch? And when will someone or who will come in and step up to check the president?
Let me stop you there, Joe, because that is a question that, you know, that I had a little civics 101 here when you're talking about separation of power. They were calling this the Monday night massacre, similar to the Friday night massacre during the Nixon administration. So, Congresswoman Norton, can you give me a little civics lesson here, and what is going on if the acting attorney general or the attorney general, which is supposed to be separate from the legislative and the executive branch, says that this isn't right, then how can you fire this person? Help me out with that.
Well, first of all, the caller raises a very important separation of powers question. The caller, though, seems to think that the Trump administration is going full steps ahead. It is not. It is obeying the court orders. It is saying that it is maintaining its position. Well, you'd expect it to maintain its position in court.
Because a stay was issued.
That is right. So it is not saying we're going to violate that stay. In fact, those stays all around the country. But it is holding to its original position. That means it is going to have to be more rigorous and go into court. And that's why I think it's going to make some accommodation when it gets into court, or else it's going to lose.
Mm-hmm. So help,
yeah,
but help
I,
me. But
I
help.
Might add, the order is being enforced in the following way, which is people are not getting on airplanes in foreign countries heading for the United States who were banned by the order. So they're not getting to U.S. airports.
But are they kept from getting on planes, or are they afraid to get on planes?
No, I think some of the latter. But, yes, my understanding is that airlines are not letting people on planes because they don't want to have to pay for their return flight free. if they get turned away at the border. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily U.S. government officials abroad who are doing this. It's perhaps airline executives. But that's at least what I've been hearing, is that a lot of people aren't being able to get on planes. And the court orders say once they've arrived on U.S. soil, they can't be sent back. But it doesn't prevent the court orders don't extend to the airports in Turkey or Egypt or Paris or London.
Okay.
So there's a lot more that the courts still need to do, in our view, and we're certainly going to be asking the courts to do that in the days ahead.
Joe, thank you so much. Professor Morris, you wanted to say something?
Well, no, I look at the provocation, the justification which he doesn't have to give for rushing this ineptly conceived order through. All he said was bad dudes would get through. Now, I don't know about the history of bad dudes in public policy making, but it doesn't seem to explain or justify it. I do think, however, there is another level of provocation, not so much with the firing of the acting attorney general, but with the failure to recognize her explanation. Now, he doesn't have to accept it, that she sees it as a violation of congressional recent law. And it seems to me they would have been better prepared or would justify themselves as consistent with law in ways that are as specific as I think need to be. The fact that they don't suggest a provocative mode as if somehow the public attention is seeming aggressive. With other elements of government, whether it is the laws passed by Congress or whether it is pushing the wall with the courts, is troubling.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Bram, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Bram. What's on your mind?
Hello. Yes. Good evening. I'm an immigrant. Before I came to the state, I read through the legislations and everything, and I know that practicing whatever religion in this country is free. So I don't think that this gentleman, Mr. President, should discriminate any of the religions, no matter what it's called. And more than that, I'm ashamed of saying that. I think this Mr. President doesn't know anything about the immigration law, because if he even consulted with one of the immigrants, he couldn't do that. And, you know, doing this, and then after like 2 days of seeing the reactions on that, blaming the previous president, saying that all these countries were in his list, that is just mindless. That is unacceptable from a gentleman who is taking the authority of this big land of opportunity. And you know what? Actually, after these kinds of, you know, executive orders that he's signing, I became, you know, more believed in this, quota that is called, the U.S. is called the land of opportunity.
Bram, let me stop you there because you do bring up an interesting point, and I need to bring Arthur back into this conversation, because this really kind of goes to the heart of what we're talking about. Arthur, what does this order exactly say? And I'm trying to get a handle on that.
Yeah, well, it's multiple pages. It's not simple enough to describe in a sentence or two. It does two basic things, separate things for refugees and other foreign people traveling to the United States. So for refugees, it's a temporary ban on all refugees coming into the country, but it makes it makes an exception. It gives a priority to people who are not of the majority religion in these listed countries. And majority people who are not of the majority religion would basically be Christians, but also perhaps people, other non-Muslim people who would get priority. And that's where I think the most obvious unconstitutional provision is, because it's really an explicit discrimination based on religion. Then for other people who are coming in with visas, whether they're immigration visas, where someone would come in and get a green card to become a permanent U.S. resident, or a tourist visa, or a student visa to come here and study at a college or university, or an employment, a visa that allows employment to work in Silicon Valley, or one person I've spoken to is a physician here in Washington, D.C. on a visa that allows him to work here, and his wife was prevented from entering the country Sunday. She has a visa that entitles her to stay with him here as his spouse. Mm. So for those various categories of visas, if you're a citizen of one of the seven named countries, then you're just not supposed to be allowed in at all during the 90-day period that this order is in effect.
Bram, thank you so much for your phone call. Congresswoman Norton, because I know we're going to lose you in about 4 minutes, but I have to ask you, give me some perspective, your observations, some color, dare I ask. How are your Republican colleagues doing on the Hill over these past 11 days or so?
Don't think it's only Democrats.
Right. Because we know how the Democrats feel. I mean, that's almost a given. But for those this is the president of their party.
And it is very difficult to speak out against your party unless you're Lindsey Graham mm-hmm. or John McCain. And they've been fearless leading the pack. I can tell you that my colleagues are put in the most awkward position. For example, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan had to say that he was for a moratorium. He can understand why they might need to have a period in which they looked to see that people entering the country should be entering the country. Mm-hmm. So he talked about the way in which it was done, but he felt he had to speak out about the way in which it was done. So the position they're put in is they're so glad to have the majority that they don't want to look like they're trying to tear down the president already. And I think that they are hoping that he will get around him some cabinet members who will hold him in check, because they are put in the most awful position. And in fact, they're put in such an awful position that they don't say anything.
It looks like political whack-a-mole to me, because just when they hit the mole for one executive order and then they've got something else, and they've got to hit it for a tweet, and then they've got to hit it for
So what it's done is silenced most in the House and the Senate because they can't support it, but they don't want to look like they're reaching out to criticize the new president after only less than 2 weeks. So they are in a worse position than we are because we can speak freely. You know, there's one thing that I'd like to ask Art Spitzer, because of all of the issues raised by this executive order, and Art and the ACLU have done this extraordinary job all over the country. The one that was most troublesome to me was that lawyers said they couldn't even get the names and didn't even know who their would-be clients were. You know, you can put habeas corpus and you can always get somebody freed. The staff apparently didn't know. And I need to know from Art, how in the world did you find who you represented when, in fact, you didn't even have access to people who were getting off the planes who needed representation?
All right, I've got a minute, so go right ahead.
Right. My understanding is we were able to get some names from relatives, people who were at airports expecting their family members to arrive, and they didn't arrive. And you know, of course, it was in the news that this executive order had been signed, so we could put two and two together.
Amazing. I want to thank D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton for coming by, because I know she's got another appointment that she needs to attend to, and she's going to be leaving us. But it's good to see you. I'm glad you're in good health also. And we'll be talking to you, because there's always something happening on the Hill, particularly in 2017. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Also, Lisa calling from Fairfax, Virginia, we're going to talk to you. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about President Trump's immigration executive order, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lisa, thanks for hanging on, calling from Fairfax, Virginia. What's on your mind?
Hi, Harold and panel.
Hi.
With Trump in this executive order, given that his and I heard it on another station early this morning, kind of tail end, given that his wife is foreign herself, what's the status of her her papers? And I heard something about the ACLU was looking into that. Is there any truth to that? And then two, if you can just say thank you to Congresswoman Norton for all her tireless hard work that she does for the people.
I will definitely pass that message on. She did have to leave, but I will certainly pass it on to her. Arthur, is the ACLU looking into Melania Trump, the First Lady's citizenship or immigration status?
Not that I'm aware of. We are not a law enforcement organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I know some questions have been raised. I imagine some people are looking into it, but I'm not aware that we're involved in that in any way.
Okay. Well, keep us posted.
Thank you.
If something like that does happen. Lisa, thank you so much for your phone call. Professor Morris, talk to me. We've spoken a lot about, you know, refugees and some of the other people that this impacts. But, you know, for our listeners, not all of us have a lot of interaction with refugees. But there are people that we do have reaction with that it may surprise us that this could impact students, college students, professors, teachers in the public school system, workers. Talk to me about the people that we would see every day that this would impact.
Well, you see them every day in a variety of social service activities and sometimes in technological ones where you don't see them, but you hear their work in a lot of the tech industries. They are highly and regularly employed in ways that make our economy function much more efficiently. I look at the student bodies of most of the universities have a large number of graduate students who either stay if there is a demand for their employment, but more often go back to countries and bring a sense of the U.S., a positive sense with them. But every student I talk to in just the past day, it just happened that a lot of them were foreign students, and many were not from the countries designated, but many had the kinds of visas that were made them feel vulnerable, and there's a sense of insecurity. So when they have an option, it means that people who pass whatever legal standard may still be protected here have a sense of insecurity, and the better choices may be to go somewhere else or to be somewhere else. On the other hand, I'm struck by something that people haven't paid a lot of attention to, which is its international impact on our allies and our friends. I asked one of my foreign students, an Austrian, a black Austrian woman, about their elections, and there was a lot of conservative movement around the world, and a lot of it tainted with a sort of antipathy towards Muslims. This student thought that the Trump getting elected affected a sudden change in the popularity of a very anti-Muslim candidate who lost unexpectedly, because people said in many parts of Europe, could this happen? In France, a big ally, there is going to be an election, and the conservative right-wing party has been running on a campaign that is very hostile towards immigration and Muslims in particular.
Specifically, we're talking about Marine Le Pen.
Marine Le Pen, whose father has a long history of a variety of both anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attitudes, so that the sudden awareness, as happened with her father, that they might win may well be provoked and provoke these countries in a different direction. More importantly, Trump is losing friends rapidly because he started by attacking German Chancellor Angela Merkel for her openness to refugees. And while you can disagree with the impact if he had data, which, you know, they have alternative data, but if he had data, then he might say something. But instead, he's just attacked the idea. At the same time, he's looking for an alternative to the European Union with the British. So the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, who just visited and had a warm greeting, now is compelled to say in front of her national audience that they don't agree with any of this, the things that the U.S. is doing. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, a million people, the largest number in Britain, sign a petition asking that he be blocked from coming as a state official representative to Great Britain. And he may see the government, but not the head of state, the queen and the head of and the aristocracy.
Arthur, you've been, let me say, you're seasoned, and you've seen a lot as it relates to these kinds of things. From your own institutional knowledge, how unusual is the kind of legal action against this president when compared to, you know, let's go back to, you know, to your Richard Nixon's, for example? Or is it that it's just, you know, high profile now, it's interesting now that memories have faded and that we've actually seen this before?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your very kind description of my gray hair. And the answer is, I think there's been legal action against presidential actions, executive orders, in every administration.
It happens all the time.
Many of President Obama's executive orders were challenged, and some of them were blocked by the courts. What's different about this particular episode is that we've got so much of this happening in just, you know, a week or 10 days, and happening in such an urgent way. I mean, often an executive order or a law passed by Congress, you can see it coming. It has an effective date. If there's going to be a challenge, the challenge can be filed before the effective date. Courts have time to think about the issues, and lawyers have time to file briefs and make arguments. You know, this came out of nowhere, was effective the minute it was signed, you know, while people were literally in airplanes over the ocean. It applied to them, and so they were stuck at airport terminals. Some people were turned around and deported. We had to run to court on a Saturday night to get, you know, get a judge in the courtroom from home to hear our case. So that's not normal. And of course, the reason it's not normal is because of the way the Trump administration acted. This could have been done. They could have, of course, vetted it internally in a more normal way. It's not normal for an executive order to come out without consulting the relevant government departments. And they could have issued it in a more normal way, and there could have been more civilized litigation. But I don't think that's their goal here. I think their goal is to create upheaval. And I suppose there are some people who think that's just why they voted for Mr. Trump, to create upheaval. And he's satisfying that constituency, but it's certainly not something that's going to make judges happy any more than it's going to make the people it affects happy. And I might point out, I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but there are lots of people in the United States who are directly affected by this order, too. It's not just their relatives abroad, but we've spoken to students here on student visas, for example, who were planning to go home to visit their families and then come back, or planning to go abroad to attend an academic conference and then come back, and, you know, they really shouldn't do it, because who knows if they'll be able to come back. And so their plans are being disrupted and their lives are being disrupted, even though they're here in the United States legally.
Do you agree with that, the upheaval suggestion that Arthur just made?
Well, I think it certainly makes, if you have a cynical view, good TV. If you think that somehow the negative imagery is going to rebound to you positively, like showing that you're forceful and powerful, and it's clear that he sees the image of a powerful leader as a very motivating kind of thing for himself and his concept of the presidency. I think that he certainly could have, no one could have anticipated the breadth and intensity of the objections, but backing down is hard if you are a want to see yourself in this kind of forceful imagery. One of the things that strikes me, and I wanted to ask the attorney about this, is I don't ever remember, even when Nixon was firing people randomly, I don't ever remember that firing taking place when the president publicly announces that the attorneys, people are betraying their cause and their country. And I think that is the kind of thing that shows a predisposition towards public imagery and displays, even negative, that get media attention. But to diminish the character of someone whom you are already firing is, I think, not precedented in presidential politics.
And finally, I wanted to ask you this, and I only have a minute left. The other piece is that a president who just stepped down has stepped in to comment. And, you know, even in, you know, my lifespan, I don't think I can ever remember any president so quickly after having left office speaking up against the incumbent, you know, the new president.
I think he must see it as a moral concern. And I think that one of the things that we may be hard to put our finger on, but is really motivating a lot of the protesters, is this image that somehow there are fundamental values at play, whether you disagree or disagree or not. They clearly seem to think that. And it might be easier to get around that claim for the president had he justified it, not just with, quote, vetting it with other people, but presenting it in a context that did not cause desperation. The willingness to accept desperate responses from people who are put unnecessarily in desperate situations means that there is a value other than those that we think of as normal with human rights and normal with refugees that he is playing to. And correctly or wrongly, it's hard to get around the idea of this strong media-sensitive image, the man looking good and powerful in front of an audience that feels that they have had no special attention. This may not be, in the end, the special attention they wanted, but for the moment, it looks unique.
Well, indeed so, and this certainly will not be the end of this kind of conversation. We have much, much more to talk about. As a matter of fact, we're going to be at the Political Roundtable, Reporters Roundtable tomorrow, talking about this and some other issues. So Arthur Spitzer with the ACLU here in D.C., legal director. Thank you so much, Arthur. I appreciate your time because I know you're certainly busy, and I'm sure we're going to be talking to you again. Also, Dr. Lorenzo Morris and D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, we want to thank her also for spending some time with us, and Dr. Morris also.